Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You're listening to a podcast from the Word.
Perry's Black Ark Studios or something.
Dear God,
it's warm in here already, isn't it?
Yeah.
Extraordinary. So we're recording, are we?
We are recording.
Oh, we are.
Good, fantastic. And Eamon Ford
is Hello.
Our guest on the podcast this week. I have to confess, Eamon, we only decided to do this about a few hours ago, to do a podcast this week before we disintegrate for the holidays.
And basically what you're going, who was sitting at home with nothing to do?
No, Eamon,
I'm desperate for the attention.
It's not true at all, but one thing we do know about you, Eamon, is because you're energetic twittering, we sort of always know whether you're awake and
yes.
in the country. You
yes.
know what I mean? And you're sort of roughly around this bit of London.
I'm
and you're very often going somewhere, aren't you?
I'm invariably on a bus somewhere.
On a bus, usually complaining about, you know, the horrible view that's in front of you,
yes.
or the queue or whatever.
Absolutely. I think I'm giving it real from the street. I am the voice of the modern commuter.
So, and I actually didn't even bother to email Eamon. I thought, no, the fastest way, let me try this. I'm just going to direct message him on Twitter and say, Eamon, could you do a podcast at 3:30 this afternoon? And their reply came straight back.
Yes.
Yes, I could.
There you go.
And here he is.
There you go.
Hello, Fraser.
Good afternoon, readers.
Before we start, actually, I thought I would do something slightly different for the podcast. I don't think this has ever been done before. I bought refreshments.
Oh, wow.
Not drugs, but I brought everybody
oh.
a finger of fudge.
A finger of fudge?
Literally,
is it
of fudge to eat at... when somebody's kind of quacking a bit too much, and maybe that's a sign that somebody's kind of dominating the conversation if everybody else opens up their fingers of fudge.
And you just disenchant. That's
there
what
is.
I was going to say. A finger of fudge is just enough
to give
your child a treat.
Your child a treat.
Or kid a treat.
Kids a treat, yeah.
A finger of fudge.
They wouldn't get away with that now, would
they? No, absolutely.
Well, Fraser and I have actually already taken... taking advantage of, what was it, Fraser, that we had about half an hour ago?
A Mars Bar Duo.
A Mars Bar Duo. I'd never been introduced to a Mars Bar Duo before.
Is that two Mars bars welded together?
It's
a king-size Mars Bar cut in half.
Oh, that's, oh, God. King-size Mars bars are the point where kind of ambition is defeated by appetite, isn't it? You look at it and you go, I could chump my way through that, and you get... literally halfway through, and then like your body starts to revolt. It becomes too rich. Did you eat all of them?
I'm a man who eats cheesecake by the kilo rather than the slice.
Right, okay.
I have to confess, Eamon, I agree with you. I think halfway through it, I was stricken by post-Mars bar remorse, and I hadn't even finished the thing. You know what I mean? The appetite for it lasts through the first one.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you can't leave the second one. You can't put it in the fridge or anything like that.
You can't share it because you've kind of slobbered all over
yeah,
it.
I suppose so, yeah. And I felt bad.
Unless Marianne Faithfull's in the building.
When I
lawyers, please cover your ears.
Yes. When I approached the second one. So, but anyway, a finger of fudge, that'll provide a bit of an energy boost.
Yeah, a bit of a sugar rush towards the end so we can kind of go a bit mental. Like, that was that podcast you did with the energy drinks, was it?
We did, with Rockstar. This is ages ago. We had delivered to the Mixmag offices, actually, were a couple of crates of Rockstar energy drink. And I'd never had one of these things before, and so we decided to use them because we're very often, in those days, we're recording the podcast late in the day, and people used to have a very different droop in energy halfway through it. And I do think it's kind of a serious point, this, actually, because the only thing that matters on podcasts is energy.
Yeah.
That's all it is. I know you may think, listeners, that it's wit, preparation, poise, all this. It's not. It's attack, attack, attack. That's how you do it. Anyway, we used to start these huge, great cans of lukewarm Rockstar. And I don't know if it's still on the market, but it was horrible. And
there's a whole load under Kate's desk if you want some more.
Is this...
Could you actually figure
it out? Kate hasn't even made cocktails out of it with Guinness and Tia Maria or anything like that. It's that bad.
Could you feel your heart kind of trying to move to the other side of your body to confuse your veins?
I saw my local Dipso coming home today from the supermarket. I watched this person.
That's a polite way of saying alcoholic, isn't it?
I suppose so.
Well, you know, no, somebody, what Dipsy mean there is just somebody with an unquenchable thirst. Not necessarily.
Oh, is it really?
It's not strictly for alcohol.
This may explain what I'm about to tell you. I see this person going, if I'm working at home, I see this person passing my front window every morning to go down the shop to return with four cans of Carlsberg Special. And then they do it later in the day, they go and get another four cans of Carlsberg Special. But I noticed in the other carrier bag that this person had two bottles of Lucozade. Now, do you think it's possible that they put the two together? Is that
kind of Lucozade super lager cocktail? Sugar and syrup and solid alcohol. It's kind of cubes of alcohol.
I think the special brew makes you drowsy, and then the Lucozade gives you a lift.
Is this some kind of like speedball? Some kind of liquid speedball?
It could be.
Is it going to be on Primal Scream's next rider?
We should drop into the Alma on the pub on Chapel Market and make inquiries about this.
They'll have a name for it.
They will have a name. Have you ever observed the Alma, Eamon?
Which one's the Alma?
Well, it's kind of the market pub, basically, halfway down Chapel Market.
What's the one at the far end by the Sainsbury's? Is it the...
Angelic?
No, it's near the Angelic.
Oh, they're just refurbishing that place. I forgot the name of it.
Is it some kind of bucolic name? Is it kind of like farmer or
something like that? Anyway, the Alma is genuinely the market pub.
Right.
And I noted yesterday that it opens in the morning at 8 a.m.
Oh, my word.
And there are customers, aren't there, Fraser?
But none of them work in the market.
Right.
Well, I don't think anybody works in the market. I just think they exist.
It's just like those post office pubs that are kind of dotted around for the people in the meal rooms that kind of work through the night. And there's certain pubs are kind of dotted around London. I think it's kind of secret knowledge.
I think that's a theory.
It's basically, it's for
the
people
doesn't
who work
attract
in the post office
people.
And rave kids off their napper on drugs.
off their what?
Off their nappers on drugs.
The Alma isn't a pub for people who work antisocial hours or odd hours. It's a pub for drinkers.
Right. It's a pub for drinkers and smokers. There is nobody in there who drinks who doesn't smoke. Consequently, its entire clientele is outside. It's never inside.
Oh,
it's as if somebody's taken a traditional pub and, like a sock, has reached their hand into it, pulled and extruded the contents of the pub onto the pavement.
It's like one of those reversible jackets that were kind of all the rage in the 80s.
It's like somebody's taken a Hogarth illustration and tipped it up. And the actual... Beer Street and Gin Lane or whatever. It really is like that. And it absolutely fascinates me every time I go past. And you see people there at 8 o'clock in the morning attacking a pint of lager.
You should go in and just to try it. Kind of take the day off.
Yeah.
You'll obviously be fast asleep by about 9:30.
Yeah. They have a karaoke, didn't they? Mark Ellen was telling us about this yesterday. They have a karaoke with what did he say? They had an Apple Mac.
Yes.
Guys turns up with an Apple Mac with a load of kind of backing tracks to Irish country and Western tunes, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And then proceeds to croon.
Oh, my word.
So anyway, that's enough of the local environment. One of the burning issues that we have to discuss this week, which I thought Eamon might be across, as they say in the media nowadays.
Okay.
Is the Mercury Music Prize
shortlist,
which I have to confess I'm not an expert on at all. Have you studied it, Eamon? Shall I go through the list? You know the list?
I don't know it off by heart, and there's a few which I guess kind of fall into the token category.
Oh, right. You can explain. You can decipher.
Right.
You know,
okay.
You have been an observer of Mercury Music Prizes in the past.
Yeah.
And, you know, Give us some insight as to how this particular list is arrived at. What do you think?
Well, it's every year people go, it's completely untypical Mercury list, which is kind of the beauty, because it's not strictly based on sales, because obviously you'll have the Brit Awards, which is there to award success, so there's an element of stuff that's crossed over, because it's had effectively 12 months to kind of build momentum. It's got some new stuff there. There is obviously a bit of a kind of anime-style bias to the thing. It's a bit indie and it's a bit cool. And if it's mainstream, it's got to have a degree of edge about it, which is probably something like LaRue fits very nicely into that. It's had a number one single. The album's done really well, which is kind of still seen as credible or slightly cutting edge for a mainstream artist on a major label.
So it's all coming from that end of things, isn't it?
But then there's obviously the ones which... like, I don't really know that much about, like Speech to Bell, who...
Speech to Bell, a good record. It's a kind of rappy poetry type.
Yeah, I played the first three songs, and I kind of find myself drifting off, and I didn't really want to hear stories about crack babies over light.
Oh, well, I love
over
them.
Light jazz. But people whose opinions I respect say it's really good, so I'm going to persevere with that one. What else is in there? Well, there's obviously Kasabian. Kasabian's kind of the big kind of beery rock monsters one.
I got a confession to make to you about how advanced my prejudices are.
Right.
As soon as somebody came along and said, there's a group called Kasabian, I made a point of avoiding them at all costs. I don't want to hear a group called Kasabian.
Is it not just a name?
This is a terrible thing to say. I think a group that decides to call itself Kasabian has decided to sound a certain way.
Well,
and my experience suggests to me that I'm not going to like the way they sound.
Wasn't that the getaway driver for the Manson family?
It's
Linda Kasabian or something was her name, hence them.
I didn't know that. Kasabian, it's quite a common surname, isn't it? So I was emailing somebody called Kasabian only yesterday. But I just decided a group called Kasabian, a group that decides its essence can be distilled into the word Kasabian, I don't want to listen to. Is that a terrible thing to say?
No, I think there is that old argument about you never judge a book by a cover. But
wrong.
But you should judge a book by a cover, because you've got marketing teams and designers who've spent time and been professional designing a book to appeal to
but
you.
But also the group, themselves. Yeah. It's actually probably their key creative decision.
Probably.
Is what are we going to be called? And what are we going to look like?
Mm-hmm.
It dominates absolutely everything that comes afterwards, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know, it's a bit of a...
So that's my prejudice.
What have we got here? We've got The Horrors. This album actually is quite good. The first album I thought was rubbish. They were this kind of style band who came through and they couldn't play. They looked kind of ridiculous, and therefore if you were 17 they looked amazing. But they just didn't have the songs. They had an idea and they had a look and they kind of had a sound, which is basically kind of reviving 60s garage rock, but they hadn't kind of learned to play. On this album they got... Jeff Barrow from Portishead produced it, and it sounds like it. They've kind of become a crowd rock band, and it's actually surprisingly good.
This is more of my prejudice.
Right, you hate crowd rock.
No, I don't. No, but it's the idea that's a band's creative, you know, progress is... Because we start off to be a garage rock band, and then we decide to be a kraut rock band, and then when we've kind of exhausted the possibility of that, we're going to be a country rock band or whatever. Mm. You know, it's all just trying on costumes.
But are you saying that they've become a krautrock band and at that point the songs have arrived? Because that sounds a bit odd to me.
They've got melodies.
Okay.
They've got melodies. They were kind of... it was a kind of explosion of kind of White Noise and kind of garage rock meets Jesus and Mary Chain style mag rubbish, basically. But the second album they've actually... I think they kind of learned to play, whether or not they were...
They've kind of been written off, haven't they, completely?
They come through on that whole kind of... that junk club scene in Southend on Sea was kind of this whole
I know
scene.
All that. junk club scene.
Well, I only know about it because I worked with somebody who kind of went to that and kind of knew all the kind of the movers and shakers as much as they were movers and shakers in that scene. So we kind of became aware of what it was all about. And they were kind of the figurehead band. There was loads of other rubbish bands that had kind of come through. But they were the one... they obviously got a major label deal. There was a load of money thrown at them, kind of Enemy front covers before the... kind of released any music properly, that kind of thing. And it was just kind of... they'd come at that point where everybody... that notion of hype just stopped exciting people, because I think it just hit critical mass, and even 17-year-olds had seen that process happening already. Where, well, I'm kind of in my late 30s, and you see that whole build, the hot new band comes through, and they're being hyped, and you just go, God, I've been through this with Philly in the band. That when you were 17 that it happened to, but I think it's got to the point now where it's been so concentrated that 17, 18-year-olds are going, yeah, that happened with that band last year. And the whole kind of bones of the industry.
So it's rotating so fast.
Yeah. So I think there's a kind of inbuilt cynicism into 17-year-olds. They're not caught up in that kind of ambition to kick against previous generations anymore. They just go, they're a bit rubbish. And they're aware of the marketing tricks and the spin a lot more than perhaps I was when I was 17.
Well, while we're talking about this, it's interesting. Another thing I wanted to talk about from another industry. But I've been fascinated to read these stories about the extraordinary effect of Twitter on opening weekends of movies in the United States. Yeah. Have you followed this?
This is just absolutely astonishing.
This was the
Bruno thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
That traditionally, you launch a movie, you spend a fortune on making the movie, but you spend most of the money on, you know, if you're Sacha Baron Cohen or whatever, jetting around the world doing photo calls at openings and getting as much press space as you possibly can, chat shows and all this, because it's all about the opening weekend. And it's all about, can you get a huge number of people into the cinemas, can you get it on loads of screens, and can you get a maximum number of people to see it Friday night, Saturday and Sunday. And this has now, in the last few months, changed. So it's not Friday and Saturday and Sunday anymore. It's not Friday and Saturday. It's Friday. Because they reckon the fate of your film is decided at about 10 past 11.
When everybody gets out.
When everybody gets out, because the first thing they do...
Seen Bruno, it's crap.
And it's actually, it's a medium built for negative messages, isn't it?
Twitter's basically just... it's kind of loads of miserable people just sitting around. It's like the knitting circle, just everybody sitting around, just who can out-whinge. Because you've got 140 characters, and you can kind of be a bit more creative in kind of criticising something. And it makes you stand out rather than go, this is amazing, LOL, smiley face. Yes. Nobody wants to see that.
It's got a really strong script and very good, very rounded characters. Yeah. You know, it wouldn't work at all, would it?
If you slag it off, I think people go, it's the best film ever made, and people will just go, no, it's not. We've heard this a million times. But if somebody goes, this is the worst film ever made, your interest is pricked automatically. You're going, I want to see if that really is that bad. I don't think we're so immune to extreme hyperbole around praise, extreme hyperbole around negativity. I think there's a degree of kind of schadenfreude about the whole thing, where we want to really see these big hype things fail. We want to see them crash and burn. We want the hype to eat itself, and for kind of everybody to kind of, all these burned, charred bodies to be pulled out of the studio system or whatever, and we just go, okay, that's it, your career's over, thanks very much, see ya.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's part of a larger trend, you see. Fraser and I often talk about we'd like to see the same thing happen in football, wouldn't we?
Yes, we would.
We'd like to see all the money go out of football tomorrow, you know, like with the sound of escaping air from a balloon, which everybody tells us would be terrible if all the money went out of Premier League football. We wouldn't care at all, would we?
No, we wouldn't.
We'd do. The clubs are still there.
My club has never had any money. I'm a Northampton Town fan.
Well, I'm not a football fan or understand anything about football, but obviously as it's become really professional and these international stars commanding all this money, that has an impact on the turnstiles. So what's your season ticket? Several hundred quid a year?
Oh, it'd be more.
I don't know. For a Premiership club, what are you paying? The guts of £1,000 a year to get the season
a top
ticket?
Premiership side, you would
like
be.
Chelsea, Arsenal, Man U, that kind of thing.
I think Spurs season tickets are about £600.
No, I think, well, okay, but it's 14,000 waiting list to get one. Yeah. So that gives you an idea of the
But
demand,
that's basically just been passed on to the fans to pay for the players. And the revival of the changing of the kit every season, all of that stuff, get the kids to pay their 60 quid whatever for the replica kit. If you removed all the money from that, it would lower the price because the overheads aren't...
Well, you wouldn't have these fabulous players in the same way, but for most people that wouldn't matter.
I think the interesting thing is going to happen when Sky get round to the next round of negotiations and realise they don't have to compete against Atlanta. They won't have to compete against the BBC for the rights. They can drop the prices and then football's really in trouble.
Well, maybe. Yeah, well, except the basic structure of it underneath ought to continue.
Yeah.
With a load of the sizzle will go, but there's no reason to believe that the steak would disappear at the same time.
What do the fans feel about that? Do they feel that they're being ripped off, or are they happy to pay for this and then
accelerate
the process?
The famous survey is the one about the Stretford end at Manchester United, where 20 years ago the average age of the person standing on the terrace was 17 and now it's 45.
Okay.
And it's purely about
the people
who go to football or the people who could afford to go to football.
So it's kind of what's happened to Glastonbury over the last 10 years.
Yes.
So it's become mainstream and it's become middle class and it's become people with a lot of disposable income.
Yeah, I don't think it necessarily. I think sometimes if you say it's become middle class, you have the impression that it's Saabs and Volvos in the car park. And
I don't buy into this idea of the kind of the earthy working class coming with their wooden shoes and their wickets and all the rest of it.
With
their beef tea to cheer on the team.
It's people. I think football. It's a bit like rock and roll gigs, really. Big rock and roll gigs are paid for by two groups of people. One is a group of people who would do that before buying food. Yes?
Yeah.
And the other is a group of people who've just got a lot of money to spend on it. And it's not a problem at all. Yeah, and that's what drives these things. But, we were talking about it last week with Andy Murray. It is the big story of popular music in the last 25 years, that to go and see a band live used to cost you about, 20% of what it cost to buy their album. And now, buying their album, which most people don't do, would cost 20% of going to see them live. It's just completely...
It's something we've probably discussed in podcasts in the past, but the price of everything else, of all other consumer goods, has gone up. The only thing, the only kind of entertainment product that's dropped in price in the last 10 years is a CD. The average price of the CD the average price for CD about 10 years ago was probably about 14 quid.
14 quid before and, discount, yeah.
Yeah, and the average retail price, I think, according to the BPI last year, was about £8.70 was the average retail price. So it's dropped.
And you can get it a lot cheaper than that.
Yeah, of course. Well, obviously, you go into FOP, for example, and everything's kind of 3 quid, 5 quid.
Oh, it's madness in FOP. You go in there and you think, I must have these records already.
Yeah.
Shouldn't I buy them again, for goodness sake?
They've got
John Wesley Harding for about 50p or something like that.
I bought Paul McCartney's Ram the other week because it was £3.
Good record.
It's a great record. I haven't had it for years. And I kind of felt really kind of dirty buying it because I felt that I was contributing to this downward pressure on CD prices. But then I felt that it was the last one on the shelves, and it kind of looked a bit sad and a bit lonely.
They probably got tons in the back.
Yeah, they probably had, but it kind of looked like the last puppy in the basket, with kind of these sad eyes looking up at me, and I felt that I had to give it a good home. I didn't want it to...
They racked them out one at a time, just for customers.
Heyman's coming in. Let's make everything look lonely. I tell you, the other thing, talk about comparative pricing that struck me. Last weekend, I made one of my periodic, pathetic attempts to clear out my room at home. And one of the things I found were old VHS cassettes. Big, real old VHS cassettes, which are big fat things in kind of laminated covers. Do you remember those things that they felt like a library book?
Yeah.
I had a copy of all of them.
The cover was twice the size of the actual cassette.
Okay. Yes. And this was all the President's Men, Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman. And I probably got this when it first came out on VHS in the early 80s, when I joined the first rental library round my way. Okay? Great excitement. Got a video player, huge great video player that you could only operate with two fingers to, press down the the controls.
A Ferguson. Was it a Ferguson?
It probably was a Ferguson. It probably was a Ferguson Video Star, which I think is what they called them. So I went down to the place called Video Fair. I thought, I've got to see, can you imagine this? Being able to rent films and take them home and watch them. How excited would that be? So I went in there and I signed up. Now, do you know what the terms were that I signed up on? Okay. You had to pay a membership fee for a year, which was, let's say it was £20. Early 80s, it's not nothing. You had to pay every time you rented a film, which might have been £1.50 or something like that. But you had to buy the first video, because that meant when you went back, you swapped the one you'd bought. Do you see what I mean? So you were always
in. So that was your deposit.
That was your deposit, effectively. Okay, how much was it, Eamon? How much was that copy of All the President's Men, early 80s?
Early 80s? The joining fee was 20 quid?
Something like that.
25, slightly more.
45. Wow. 45
pounds?
45 pounds. And they actually used to sell in those days, the control of the prices was such that if a Disney film came out, to make sure it wasn't sold, they would sell copies for rental, yes? Ostensibly, you couldn't properly buy it, but they used to price them in such a way that only the shops could afford to buy them. So I have at home copies of, like, Snow White with a label on it saying £75. Okay? And people did it.
Yeah.
People did it. It was just a fantastic luxury you were really happy to have. And you can't believe what's happened to the prices of these things nowadays, you know. Whereas I don't never buy DVDs unless I see something, you know. I see something on Amazon. The other day I bought HMV.com. Somebody sent this round as a tweet, actually, or it appeared on the site. Terry Thomas box set. This is not advertising. Nobody's paying me to do this. Terry Thomas box set on HMV.com. Was it £5.99?
I think it might have been cheaper than that. I think it was
£4.99. It might even have been £3.99.
Quite possibly.
£3.99 for three high-quality works of the great Terry Thomas on DVD, delivered to your door.
That's funny.
You know, 25 years after you've paid £48 for a copy of All the President's Men.
The Word, a magazine, a website, a podcast, a way of life.
Anyway, back to the Mercury Music Prize. Florence and the Machine.
Florence and the Machine, I think, is that's the one that's kind of got everybody's backs up. And I think I understand the Mercury's kind of reasoning about they're not driven by sales and stuff, and they're trying to judge things purely aesthetically. That's the one album that I can say is objectively awful.
Oh, right.
I think it's absolutely terrible. It's the worst case of kind of style over content. I think it's a heartless, soulless, empty husk of an album that's trying desperately to take lots and lots of kind of cookie female singer-songwriter kind of budget, Kate Bush kind of thing. And you can kind of see what they're trying to do. And they're falling short on just about everything. And then you hear the songs. And you just go, oh, this whole project, you kind of feel like you've been egged or something.
So that'll probably win.
If I hear anything, it invariably does very, very well. So I'm kind of the anti-Midas touch as far as A&R is concerned. But I think that's a shocking... I know people get really upset, but I think it's a genuinely bad album.
You see, I want to hear that now, you see. On the Twitter, criteria, I want to actually go and hear it, if it's supposed to be that bad. Whereas most of them, I've just got no interest in them. I look at these lists, and my reaction is like seeing the shortlist for the Booker Prize. I just feel that somebody's wanting you to eat your greens. You know what I mean? Yeah. It seems to me to be antithetical to the entire... beauty of popular music, to me.
There was a couple of things that obviously people have picked up on that were kind of surprising in their omission, and I think the Lily Allen thing, I think, was a massive oversight, because you've obviously got people like LaRue and Florence and Bat for Lashes who kind of came in that wave, and she was the architect of that.
She's done
a genuinely great album, and I think as a pop star, she's fantastic. She's fantastic value for money. And I think it's a great album, and it sold really well, and I think that should have been included.
Now, I tell you what, I know what the best British pop album of the last year is, and I know this even though I haven't heard it.
What is it?
Okay? And I'm going to tell you this, and I know you'll agree. And I know it's great because I'm such an old git. I can tell the pattern of something being great, which is loads of people who don't have to telling you how good it is, okay?
Okay.
The best album of the last year, and I speak as somebody who hasn't heard it, is the Madness album, The Liberty of Norton, it's called.
It's phenomenal.
Everybody says this is brilliant. And the point is that you don't win any points by saying Madness are groovy. You know what I mean?
Do you think they're too old for the Mega?
Well, I know it's kind of Andrew Harrison's wrote it up as kind of, he said it's a masterpiece, and I'm completely inclined to agree with him.
Everybody who's heard it says this is brilliant.
It's so good. I mean,
to say that somebody's 10th album or whatever it is is brilliant, takes some saying. You have to be convinced of it. Do you know what I mean?
It's a band with a kind of renewed purpose and renewed focus. They've kind of written what is ostensibly a concept album, but it doesn't feel forced in that way. And I saw them last Friday in Victoria Park at Madstock, a kind of semi-annual festival. And they played a good chunk of the album in among all the hits. And like the audience reaction didn't change at all. They,
right.
They played, I don't know, they would have played one of the new album tracks and then they would have played, I don't know, House of Fans.
Yeah, yeah.
And you didn't have that point where people were drifting off. People were singing along to the new album.
Well, I'm so convinced it's the greatest record of the last year, I'm actually going to listen to it.
It's really, really good.
Yeah, it's, but I know I will not be wrong.
Yeah.
Because I know that these on this list are, they will be overrated. Mm. They just will be overrated. It's like records by young bands are always overrated.
But the
third records are always underrated, because there's no points to be gained by saying that, you know, when you get the Claxons' third record, there's no points to be gained. You know, Radio 1 presenters are not saying, oh, how fantastic it is, because there's no points.
I think the great thing about the Madness album is you've got people who were, obviously at the time, in the first wave, were great, great musicians, but didn't show off. But there's been a lot more subtlety in their playing. And they kind of, they obviously, they know how each of them plays and how they all work together, and just the cohesion of the whole thing is just.
Well, I'm going to listen to it.
It's a really beautiful album.
And they've got a token folk album, Lisa Hannigan, See So or whatever it's called.
I
understand a token jazz record, Lead Bib by Sensible Shoes, which will not win.
No,
because those token things never win. The one that should have won the Mercury Prize years ago and didn't was the fantastic Normal Waterson first solo record on Hannibal, which is an absolute masterpiece.
Mm,
but it was clearly just put in there to say, oh, we haven't all, you know, not everybody on this list is young and groovy, you know. But anyway, so that's the Mercury Music Prize.
So we hold our nose at the Mercury list.
Well, I just, you know, I'm sure there's quite enough people enthusing about these kind of things, so that's fine.
Well,
I'm just allowed to put the alternative.
Well, it is a bit of a national sport to kind of complain about it.
It is.
So it's fine. They know it. They're critics. They should be able to take it.
Have you seen the story about Michael Parkinson and who do you think you are? Do you watch Who Do You Think You Are? The BBC.
I watched it last night with Chris Moyles,
which I didn't see. Which apparently
was
very
really good.
Really good.
I thought it was a good series. I thought he was
a
boorish idiot, and I thought I'm going to really hate this. And then I started to watch it, and I kind of got drawn in. And then he just came across fantastically well. I think just when he was out of that kind of zoo radio bubble, and he was around his family in Leeds, and he was a lot more humble.
Because you can't do that with
your family. Yeah, but obviously, well, he's known for being a loudmouth, and you could get away with that because he could go, I'm the famous son. But he was behaving very normally in front of his mum and dad, and then he was meeting up with old family because they traced his family back to Ireland, to Dublin, and then to.
So what was the twist of the story? There's always
well,
a little.
The twist was that they didn't really know much about his paternal grandfather, and his paternal grandfather was recruited by the British Army to fight on the front in fighting in Belgium or Holland, I believe, during the First World War, and he actually he was shot in the trenches.
Right.
So there was a little bit where they find.
Was there a bit where he cried?
Yeah.
There was a bit where they cried.
Yeah. There was the bit like he was being shown around where they where the battles were taking place, and he was kind of being silver-facing about it, going, yeah, I know this is going to get really bad because we know how it ends, we know he dies, but they didn't know the details of it.
Yeah.
And basically, they'd find this little bit in the local paper where one of the other soldiers had talked about his experiences about people from the town, and then he mentioned his Chris Moyles' granddad, and what happened was that he basically just stuck his hand up over the trench, and he was just shot through the forehead. That was it.
They actually know the circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's exceptional. Because obviously, the interesting thing about the Michael Parkinson story was that he was approached, and they said, we'd like to do Who Do You Think You Are about you. And he said, fine, love to, you know, as anybody would, I would have thought. And then they came back 6 weeks later and said, nah, we don't want to do it anymore because we haven't found anything at all. Because it's just clearly, teams of researchers go off, look into it.
Yeah.
And then basically they come back and say, have we got a bit where he cries?
Mm.
Have we got just...
Well,
it's generally a bit
Springer
that involves...
syndrome, isn't it?
It's a voyage and a bit where they cry. Is and there wasn't anything at all. And so I felt kind of sorry for Michael Parks.
Is this a bit of spin, though, where they're saying that... they're saying on the surface that there wasn't enough interesting stuff in his history, but it's Michael Parkinson objecting to a programme that isn't entirely about him?
Oh, I don't know.
Because he not like, who do you think you are? Michael Parkinson would just like a programme going, I'm me, I'm brilliant.
Oh, no, I don't know about that at all.
Solipsistic, grumpy...
Oh, well, absolutely. But it made me think, you know, I'm a great believer in Alan Bennett's, you know, dictum that all families have a secret, and the secret is they're not like other families. Yeah. And so if they then approach you, Fraser, hello, this is, who do you think you are? We'd like to make a program about you. We can't afford the researchers to go off and find out if there's a little thing in your story that will work. What would you tell them, Fraser?
Well, I know there's stories in my family that would work.
So. Okay, go on, give us one.
I have a great uncle who was involved in the Troubles in Northern Ireland, funny enough.
My word.
Was wanted by the police and escaped to America on his twin brother's passport.
Oh, that's good.
Never to be seen again.
Oh, wow.
Never, and disappeared.
Disappeared.
And how long ago is this?
This is, again, the first couple of decades of the last century.
Oh, right, so he won't be still alive for anything like that. Okay.
That's a great story.
That's a good one. Eamon, what about you?
I don't know if there's anything...
There must be.
I don't know, because kind of Irish Catholic families kind of behaved themselves. So my granddad came from right in the very south of Ireland as a teacher, and I don't know if I kind of misunderstood something. There may have been a case where he remarried... because his first wife possibly died. I need to speak to my parents about this. But he married what was my grandmother because he was teaching in England. He was a headmaster. And I think it was him coming to the local village where he was the headmaster and taught everybody. And everybody kind of in the area for miles knew my family because my granddad was the headmaster at the primary school. And I think it was slightly, there was a degree of controversy around him coming there because he'd been married before.
I think there's a film here.
He hadn't been divorced, as I understand it, and again, it reminds me, I should actually speak to my parents about this. But I think that his wife died not long after... they were married, so he married again. But even then, that was frowned upon too.
Do you know what my advice to you, again, as an old git, this only comes out when somebody dies. All family secrets are passed on the night that somebody dies. Well, and that's a terrible thing to say.
It's the great thing about
you,
these.
You all go back to the family and, you know, mother or whatever tells you something. I didn't properly know until my father died, which is quite a few years ago, that he was one of six, and the other five were by one mother, and the sixth was by the sister of the mother. Okay.
Oh, that's quite common.
Quite common. It makes you think to hear about it nowadays, but in those days, not uncommon.
Well, isn't that
people used to deal with odd little things
it wasn't that the Eric Clapton thing, where his sister was his mum, or was
Eric Clapton had the same syndrome as Jack Nicholson, which is that he was born to a teenage mother.
Yes.
And they used to just go away with the mother, and then the mother would return and say, I've got another baby.
Yeah.
Whereas actually the baby was the daughter's. And so Jack Nicholson famously didn't find out until he was already a star when Time magazine rang him up. Fact checker from Time magazine rang him up and said, can I just confirm, Mr. Nicholson, that the woman that you call your mother is actually your grandmother? And he genuinely didn't know. You know, and he was about late 30s before he knew, which makes you think. Anyway, so, you know, there is... In every family, I believe this, you know, there is always some little story. Whether you know it or not, there is just something. So we could all make a, you know, who do you think you are?
Yeah, well, obviously, but this program is kind of, it's become a bit of a formula. And
definitely.
And they want the money shot, which is the tears.
The crying. The only person who wouldn't cooperate with the money shot was Jerry Springer, oddly enough, who lost...
Yeah, but that was the one at the concentration
camp. Lost people
at
Auschwitz one of those.
And
camps.
There's a man who makes his living from.
There's a man who makes his living by the most naked, you know, manipulation of public displays of emotion. He wouldn't do it. He walked away. He walked out of the shot. I give him points for doing that.
But that's like kind of the equivalent in a horror movie of not seeing the monster. It became much more powerful not seeing him. The fact that you could just see him walking into the distance and you couldn't hear it, and you were imagining what he was going through.
I think
the fact that it was just off camera made it much more harrowing.
So while we're talking about in defense of, you know, of millionaire TV and film stars, I came to the office this morning. I saw the Evening Standard hoarding that said Jude Law hits woman pictures. Have you seen this?
No.
<That's right>. It's a very arresting thing to have on a hoarding. Jude Law hits woman. You think, what woman? His mother? Or, you know, next door neighbour or whatever. Slightly different twist. Photographer, okay? Happened to be female.
Right.
And coming out of some restaurant, 1 o'clock in the morning or whatever, and, you know, this woman was there to take a picture of him. He just had enough, you know, and kind of flipped or whacked her with the side of his hand or whatever. Now, obviously, violence against anybody is to be abhorred. But I sympathise with these guys now. Am I wrong? You know, I think these people, there are now such armies of people going around taking pictures of anybody who's even half famous.
Yeah, well,
it's just gotten ridiculous.
I think we can sit in that kind of non-famous world and kind of think, oh, well, they kind of live by the media, they should die by the media, and they get paid enough, etc., etc. But you don't actually see what it's like until you see any of those documentaries about paparazzi, and there's literally hundreds of them for some non-entity celebrity coming out of some nightclub or some restaurant, and they just say you can't actually see, and there's thousands of lights.
If you go and look on YouTube, I mean, people, particularly people like Paris Hilton and you know, anybody in Hollywood, because nowadays people head to Hollywood not to be stars, but they take a video camera with them, don't they? To see what shots they can pick up outside the Ivy or whatever and sell to some website.
Talking of that, the only time I've ever kind of experienced that without actually kind of having seen it kind of in the distance or on TV was I went once to the Ivy for a friend's birthday. It wasn't any kind of famous post. I've been once. We lived in London for 15 years. I've been once. And as we came out, there was like probably about a dozen paparazzi. I think Claudia Schiff, is she the one who's married to Steele?
Yeah, and
Heidi Klum.
Heidi
Klum and Seal were in having their dinner, and like somebody pointed
having
out.
Having the tea.
Yeah. Fish and chips taken away, eaten off their lap, off a little tray in front of the telly. Apparently they were in there, I didn't see them, because I think they kind of usher the normals or the civilians into one bit, and then the really famous people into some kind of insane kind of cocaine-fueled jacuzzi or whatever they're all in. But the door opens, and we were just about to go home. And you could just see, they pause for a second, and then you could just see the massive disappointment in their faces.
Yes, it's demoralising for anybody who's not Heidi Klum, isn't it?
But it was like you were properly taken aback by the whole thing. I wasn't expecting, but obviously as a celebrity, you know that that's how you're prepared for it. But still, to be kind of circled by these people, you automatically become quite defensive.
I had this weird experience. I may have told you this a few years ago. I'll do anything for money, you know. And the Audi cars have an Audi channel on Sky. And they feature, one of the things they feature is famous people driving their cars. And they, you know, the people they have associations with, Alec Ferguson and so forth. And I was approached by a production company, said, would you drive around London with Brian Ferry for the day in an Audi, interviewing him? And I said, is the money involved? Yeah. Not a problem at all. Actually, I would probably have done it for nothing. You know, it's fun to drive a luxury Audi around London with Brian Ferry, who was a perfectly sweet gentleman.
Yeah,
you know,
talk about how you record it, do the Strand and Virginia Plains.
Well, just
tell us about that.
No, the beauty of driving around while interviewing people is the conversation is really easy, because it's the same conversation you have driving with anybody, which is, oh, look at the traffic. Mm. Oh, there's Buckingham Palace. Have you ever been there? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a natural conversation. Anyway, we're going around
in
an Audi.
Was it a program called Ferrying Ferry?
Well, a bit. I'll tell you, there's a payoff, actually, in the end. So the Audi is all kitted out with, you know, onboard cameras. So you're shooting it like Jeremy Clarkson shoots Top Gear. That's how they do it. You know, it's plumbed in, cameras absolutely everywhere. So the crew are not in the car. The crew are following you in their own vehicle. Anyway, we've done lots of things. We shot all over the place. And at the end, he says, I just want to go to Sotheby's in South Ken, because this is the last day of a Francis Bacon showing, and I just want to pop in and see it. And would you mind driving me? I said, no, it's not a problem at all. He said, you should be able to wait outside, you know, because I'm driving the car. So we go, and we park outside. He said, I'll be about 10 minutes. And he nips in. And it's quite a quiet spot. And I'm just looking across the road, and there's a guy hanging around outside an off-license, just a bloke. There's no camera or anything like that. But he's kind of looking at the car, and he's looking at Christie's or Sotheby's, whichever it is, that Ferry's just gone into. And I'm looking nervously around in case a parking, the traffic warden comes or anything. And after 10 minutes, Brian Ferry comes out. And just as he's getting into the car, there's a kind of flash, you know. This guy has leapt across the road. Bang, 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 bang. You know, taking pictures of Brian Ferry. Brian Ferry gets in the car, and he's A, embarrassed, and B, he really looks invaded. You know, he looks as if he's kind of, you know, his privacy has just been disturbed for no great reason at all. What's the value of a bloody picture of Brian Ferry in a suit on a London street?
You know, he's not on duty. Him showing up to the Q Awards, then he's on duty.
Or him with a 20-year-old blonde that they haven't seen before, yes, or his son, or whatever. I was just amazed, and it gave you an idea of how this new paparazzi world worked. You know, there was a time when there were only about 20 paparazzi in London, and they were all a bit the same thing, didn't they? There'd be a big awards do or something. Nowadays, it's thousands of people on scooters, zooming around all over the place, informed on mobile phones by doorman or anybody. Oh, I've got so-and-so in here now. You know, there'd be a little queue outside. It's absolutely astonishing.
I've got, with that Brian Ferry thing, I've got this image now of the cover of For Your Pleasure with the chauffeur, you as the chauffeur, and then this slinky lady with a panther on a leash.
Yes,
I've got this image of, you know, it's going to be fixed forever.
And anyway, wouldn't you know it,
later on.
The film never got shown, it didn't get shown immediately, because a couple of weeks later, in doing an interview with a German magazine... it's just got the, you know, we've all heard this controversy, James Brown and all that got fired because of it. You're not allowed to say anything pertaining to Germany in the 1930s that doesn't make it absolutely clear that you are or absolutely anything to do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think he just said the Nazis had a strong sense of visual style, which anybody with half a brain knows is true.
Well, they had propaganda.
They invented visual style. Right now, look at the Rafe-style films.
Yeah, the idea of political iconography and propaganda.
He just said that, and so there was a scandal, and Audi, being a major German company, said, oh, can't have that. And so the film, you know, was suppressed.
Oh, goodness.
It was probably shown eventually. Anyway, sorry. We're talking about... We don't hold with anybody thumping anybody in the street, but Jude Law, we do feel a certain amount of sympathy for. I've got a
Did he take the law into his own hands?
I've got a note here on my notes, Fraser. It says, ask about Fraser's fridge. What's in Fraser's freezer?
Camel.
A what?
Well, I can do better than this. I'll give you a list of what
it's
I had in
my... list of the inventory of Fraser's freezer.
This is what was in my freezer a year ago.
It's written down.
Good lord.
I had a batch lot of exotic meat delivered.
where do you get this from?
From an exotic meat butcher. Over the internet, of course.
Right.
But I had kudu, zebra, alligator, kangaroo, bison, blesbok, buffalo.
I'm going to interrupt. Were these all neatly in white cellophane things... with little tickets on saying kudu.
Yes, completely. What did they get to? Buffalo, crocodile, eland, impala, python, springbok, and wildebeest. And now I only have camel left.
There's just a camel left.
It's very tough. Not good to cook with.
But my concern about that is I'd like to try all of those, but is there a certain expertise in knowing how to cook these particular meats, or do you just kind of treat them... as a bit like steak.
I treat them exactly like steak. With the zebra, I made a lovely zebra Wellington.
Okay. Oh, very nice.
He famously got some hare, H-A-R-E, this is ages ago, and what did he make, Eamon? You've got to guess. What did he make out of hare, H-A-R-E? He made hairballs.
Oh.
Hey!
Oh, God. Hairballs. It stings my eyes.
It's getting so warm in here. We've got to get some air in and probably attack our fingers of fudge.
I'm opening mine now.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word. Details at wordmagazine.co.uk.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Tsinis.
Kayla Tsinis. I'm Kayla Tsinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.